Frances turns her attention back to the book and ignores Lily. Frances? No response. Frances! What? Slapping down the prayer book. Is Ambrose going to bring me presents? A lump of coal if you're bad. But what if I'm good? Ambrose doesn't really care if you're bad or good, Lily. Oh, he just cares if you're okay, if you're happy.
How come?
Because he loves you. Frances looks straight at Lily. Lily puts on her most seriously attentive face. Don't you know who Ambrose is, Lily?
He's our wee baby brother who died.
He's your guardian angel. Lily's forehead puckers.
Everyone has a guardian angel, don't they, Frances?
Yes, but most people don't know who theirs is. You're lucky. You know who yours is. And that he's your very own brother, and he's watching over you. And he loves you. He really loves you, Lily.
Don't cry, Frances.
I'm not crying.
Yes, you are.
Frances wipes her eyes. Her throat constricts. Yes, she's crying. Why? She didn't feel sad until she started crying.
Frances? Frances, let's go up and look in the hope chest.
But Frances is crying.
Frances, do you want to give Raggedy Lily of the Valley a bath? You can. I'll let you give her a bath if you want. Do you want to wear my brace? You can. I'll let you.
Frances has dropped my gift to Jesus. Lily picks it up and reads silently, poring over the bright pictures. When Frances feels better, Lily will ask her what I-N-R-I means. It's the thing written on the scroll that's always nailed at the top of Jesus' cross. I-N-R-I.
I'll ask Frances, thinks Lily. Frances will know.
Late that afternoon, Mercedes comes home crying too, but for a different reason. In the car, she told Daddy it was because she and Helen had been talking about all the poor children in the hospital. James simply nodded. Mrs. Lvovitz has informed him that girls of this age are likely to become emotional. The last thing one ought to do is tell them not to cry. He watched Mercedes get safely into the house. Then he turned the car around and headed back downtown, having forgotten to drop by the post office. Mercedes tiptoes up to her room and closes the door quietly. She doesn't want to have to see anyone or explain anything. She lies face down and weeps into her pillow. Today, a miner called Mr. Davis was shot dead. There was a riot at the power plant out on Waterford Lake. The miners went there to flush out the company police and turn the water and lights back on for the town. The miners had sticks and stones and cinders. The police had guns and horses. But the miners won. Except that some got shot. And poor Mr. Davis, who wasn't even in the fight, was killed. He was on his way home with milk for his youngest. They found a baby bottle in his pocket. Now there are 7 more fatherless children in New Waterford. But that's not why Mercedes is crying. This afternoon, Helen Fry's daddy came home with a bullet in his wrist. While Mrs. Fry took the bullet out, Mr. Fry took a long drink from a medicine bottle and told Mercedes that he was most regretful because I know you're a nice girl, Mercedes, but I only have the one child, see, and I can't have her associating with the Pipers. Mercedes' eyes filled up, and her face felt scalded. She felt mortified, as though someone had caught her in a shameful private act. But she could not think of anything she had done wrong. Mrs. Fry just continued digging in Mr. Fry's wrist, while he turned white but didn't flinch, and spoke in a kindly voice, words that cut Mercedes apart. He said Mercedes' father was a bad man, a bootlegger, a scab, an enemy of this town. Then Helen was told to go upstairs, and Mercedes was asked to wait in the front room until her father came to pick her up in his automobile. Now, Mercedes curls onto her side and catches sight of Valentino, perched in his frame on her dresser next to the china figurine of the old-fashioned girl. Valentino invites fresh tears, but they are tears of consolation. "At least I still have you, my love." And the old-fashioned girl reminds her how nice her daddy is. He is. He is a kind, good man. And if daddy is forced to do certain things, it is only because he loves us so much, and we don't have a mother to look after us. Fresh tears. Mercedes can hear Mama singing, and this is too much. She covers her head with the pillow and forces the sound from her mind. She banishes the memory and focuses on what is important. My family. Helping my father, who is a good, good man, who looks after his crippled daughter all day long. If Mr. Fry and everyone else could see Daddy with Lily, then they'd know. Mercedes has grown calmer, and her eyes drift now to the picture of Bernadette in the grotto with Our Lady of Lourdes. Bernadette has been beatified. Some day she will be a saint. They dug her up, and she was sweet as a rose. That's the odor of sanctity. She was a little crippled girl, too. Maybe people hated her father as well. Mercedes has cried herself almost to sleep. But before she tumbles under, a plan forms in her mind. Tomorrow she will take Lily for a walk. They will go together to the hospital. Not to the wards. She doesn't want Lily to catch anything. Just to the reception area. And there, Mercedes will have Lily give all their old storybooks and clothes, as well as several pies that Mercedes will bake, to the poor children suffering upstairs. Then people will see. What a good man. It took James an unusually long time to drive to the post office, because several streets were impassable. Rocks bounced off the hood of his automobile, and a horde of young men descended and began to rocket to and fro. He gunned through them but found Plummer Avenue likewise swarming. A bunch of dismounted company police were being kicked, prodded, and paraded toward the jailhouse. Women ran behind the prisoners, brandishing hatpins and using them, too. There would be trouble tonight. James drove to the shore road, parked, and made it on foot through side streets back to the post office. He could have put off the errand till tomorrow, but he considered that the post office and half the buildings on the main street might be burned to the ground by then, and he was expecting money. He enters the post office, collects his cash, and is about to leave when... "There's a letter here, too, Mr. Piper." James reaches to take the envelope from the clerk. Mail is fairly rare. Packages and pictures sometimes come for Francis. James vets them before handing them over. He has confiscated more than one bottle of coca wine for brain fag and listlessness. At the moment, the post office is buzzing with the day's events, and people are glued to the windows watching the mob go by. But it all fades to silent stillness around James as he catches the sight of the name on the front of the envelope. Miss Kathleen Piper. He loses consciousness for a split second, like a blink inside the head, accompanied by the flash of a camera. Then the sound of excitement floods back in around him, and for an instant he thinks the uproar is all about the fact that someone has sent a letter to Kathleen Piper. Someone has written to my daughter, not knowing, or perhaps knowing, she is dead. Just the sight of her name, in letters scripted by a living hand, so unlike the letters carved in stone at the edge of town. This is why the light in his head flashed and faded on the fleeting notion that she was alive after all. That must be what insanity is like, thinks James. Except that the flash lasts forever. Maybe that would be good. He is back in the car before he can bring himself to open the letter. He remembers another letter so long ago. Anonymous. Horrible. It changed everything. He breaks the seal. He unfolds the page. A refined and ladylike hand. He reads, "Dear Kathleen, I was so sorry to learn of your terrible accident. You are obviously a very brave girl, and you are also a lucky one to have such a nice father. Maybe one day you will be able to leave your wheelchair and run and play again. I hope so. Here is a signed photograph for your collection, with my best wishes. Yours truly, Lillian Gish." James presses the electric starter on the Hupmobile and heads for home. He will take Frances out to the shed and ask her to explain the joke. That night, Mercedes, Lily, and Daddy stand on the veranda and glimpse the torches processing through town. Frances is upstairs in bed with a damp cloth to her face. James has the car packed and gassed up in case they all have to leave in a hurry. The army won't be here for another couple of days, and until then, it's better to be prepared. First, the miners burn down number 12 wash house. Then they raid the company stores. They don't burn them for fear of setting the whole town on fire. Then they go to the jailhouse to lynch the company police. But the priest meets them and talks them out of it. There are enough fatherless children in New Waterford. To where your heart has ever been. October 31st, 1918. Dear Mr. Piper, your daughter is in grave danger. Knowing Kathleen to be of good family and blessed with prodigious musical gifts, I feel it my duty to you and to the world to sound the alarm. Sir, you are from another country, and perhaps fortunate enough to be unfamiliar with the very term miscegenation. It is a modern evil, and it is weakening the fabric of our nation. It now threatens to claim your own daughter. Through cunning seduction and flattery, your daughter has been ensnared in a net of godless music and immorality. I look on helpless to intervene because I am an invalid. I speak as one who knows to her own cost when I say that by crossing nature's divide, your daughter courts her own ruin and can end only by yielding to the dark remnants of the beast in man. It is perhaps not too late. She is yet young. It is your prerogative to ignore, yea, to condemn the report of a stranger. My conscience dictates this letter. Thus discharged of my Christian duty, I remain an anonymous well-wisher. Since first you were my bonny bride. Book 4. The Old French Mine. Lest we forget. Lily's foot is bleeding. She doesn't know it, because the bagpipes are drowning out the pain. This is what bagpipes are designed to do. But even if she felt the pain and saw the blood soaking the back of her stocking, Lily would not stop marching, because she is on top of the world. She is carrying the Nova Scotia flag up Plummer Avenue. Her heart and lungs are big and plaid like the tartan bags of air that feed the pipes. And for once, Lily's type of walking is the ideal type. The sway and lilt of her unevenly matched legs go with the every second beat, flex, and swing of the music. Lily has a big open smile on her face and tears in her eyes. The pipes always make her feel tragic and elated all at the same time. With a poppy pinned to her tartan sash, she feels like a brave soldier. It is November 11th, 1929, Armistice Day. Today we remember the war to end all wars. New Waterford is out in force. Plummer Avenue is lined. Even James is out. Not in his capacity as veteran, but as proud father. Mercedes stands at his side in front of Cribb's bookstore. Across the street, Lvovitz's kosher Canadian is closed, the blinds drawn down. There is no danger of them forgetting this day, but Mrs. Lvovitz prefers them to do their remembering at home, far from the sights and sounds of sacrifice and honor. Frances is supposed to be here, but she is at the Empire Theater, watching Louise Brooks in Pandora's Box again, before the authorities get wind and it gets banned. The parade swings toward the Miners' Monument. Although it was erected in memory of the 65 who died in the explosion of 17, it has become a symbol of all the others who have been killed in battles both foreign and domestic. Those like Mr. Davis, who were shot in the street, and all those who would ever have been or will be blown up or gassed in a trench or mine. The pipes fall abruptly silent. Lily and the rest of the parade march onward to the stark beating of the drums until they halt at the monument. Then it's 2 minutes of silence. You can hear the ocean. You can hear birds and the wind. You can hear the poppies blow in Flanders fields between the crosses row on row. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. Men have stony expressions on their faces, their hands folded in front. Women look severe. Everyone remembers their dear ones who will always be young. Then a wrenching groan, a high-pitched wail. The drones start up and the pipes are on the march again. This releases tears, although the bagpipes do people's keening for them. A primitive reed instrument awakens something very old and puts sorrow in a consolingly long perspective, perhaps because grass is the oldest musical instrument for all kinds of people. Lily feels secure among all the hard, hairy, pale male knees, keeping time between socks and swinging sporrans and swaying kilts. She feels a camaraderie with the men, as if they'd all fought the war together. She would like to be a soldier. She's 10. She would like to be a veteran when she grows up. She wouldn't be afraid of the pain or the bullets. She'd leap over the top and charge with bare knees into battle. Daddy got the DSO medal. She knows because Mr. McIsaac told her. It's only when the pipes and drums cease, and the brass band at the rear strikes up Rule Britannia, that Lily feels the first twinge in her left foot, the little one. Her brown boot, with the built-up sole that Daddy made specially, is firmly harnessed between the steel supports of her brace, but it has been rubbing the top of her heel because it's new. A red stain has spread around her ankle. Lily steals a look, but doesn't miss a beat. There are Daddy and Mercedes. There are Mr. and Mrs. McIsaac. Lily gives them what she hopes is a manly smile. Many people, not just those she knows, smile back. Lily is unaware of the stigma surrounding her father, and people, not only her family, conspire to keep her that way. There are plenty of children with braces on their legs, some with crooked backs, too. But Lily is the only one out marching. She is also the prettiest child ever to have been stricken, and the sweetest. Lily has become well known in town thanks to Mercedes, but she has become well-loved because of herself. New Waterford hasn't changed much. The company stores have gone. Besco never reopened them after the looting of 25. Many miners went back to work with an 8% wage cut, but many others were blacklisted as Bolsheviks and wound up moving south of the border to Boston and to the mills and lumber camps of New England. It was the beginning of the exodus to points south and west, which shows no sign of stopping. The crash of 29 rocked the world, but registered as a ripple in Cape Breton, where it takes a while for the depression to sink in because it had already been going on for so long. Besides, It is widely believed that Nova Scotia's catastrophe occurred in 1867 with Confederation. Anything since then has just been an aftershock. No one can imagine how the 30s could be worse than the 20s. And as R.B. Bennett is fond of saying, prosperity is just around the corner. But nothing can dampen civic pride. The turnout today shows that. Cape Bretoners have reconciled loyalty to king and country with scorn and skepticism for all things from away. The foolish arses in Upper Canada and the useless bowler hats in Whitehall. They are fiercely proud of their veterans, yet bitter about the Canadian army that has so often invaded the coal fields. In spite of this, the armed forces are increasingly an option for the jobless and the working poor looking to get off this cursed, godforsaken rock that they love more than the breath in their own lungs. There is no such place as down home unless you are away. By November 1929, the process is underway whereby, eventually, more people will have a down home than a home. Remembrance Day tends to stir up a lot of mixed emotions. On days like this, prohibition seems doubly ludicrous. By evening, kitchens will overflow with music and family and conversation. Jugs and cups of tea will be passed around. Mounties will turn a blind eye to hotel bars and speakeasies, and more than one brawl will add to the evening's entertainment. James will not work tonight, and he certainly will not socialize, although this is the one night when bridges might be mended. He is a veteran, after all, and decorated. But this is also one of two nights in the year when he does not trust himself near a bottle, because he wishes to forget, not remember, the day the armistice was signed. All over town, people are asking each other the ritual question, "Do you remember where you were the day the war ended by?" James remembers all too well. He was in New York City. He was in Giles's apartment in Greenwich Village. He was walking through the front door because it was unlocked. He had called out, but no one answered. He is walking down the hallway. The apartment smells like lavender. He is looking for Kathleen. He finds her. Stop. Tonight, James needs to be safe at home in the bosom of his family. Frances is already home playing piano, imagining her future life as a white slave cabaret dancer in Cairo, playing Mama's forbidden music from the Hope Chest. Daddy says it's colored music. Put it away. She is bobbing on the bench to Coal Black Rose when James and Mercedes rush in with Lily. Daddy carries Lily upstairs, and Mercedes follows. Frances leaves the piano and takes the steps two at a time to the bathroom, where Daddy unrolls the stocking that's stuck to Lily's tiny foot, and Mercedes gets the carbolic acid. Lily doesn't cry out at the pain. She just looks over Mercedes' shoulder at Frances in the doorway. Frances says, "It's okay, little gingerbread boy," which is one of their special codes, adding, "Hey, olla que lubas helm." Lily's gaze does not waver as she replies, "Inshallah." James glances at Frances in the doorway but says nothing. Mercedes bandages Lily's foot, praying that there won't be a scene later. Inshallah is Lily's magic word. It is from the language that she knows ought not to be used by day except in an emergency, because the words are like wishes from a genie. Don't waste them. Lily has not even a rudimentary understanding of Arabic. It is rather dreamlike. At night, in bed, long after lights out, she and Frances speak the strange language, their bed language. Frances uses half-remembered phrases and tells fragments of old stories, weaving them with pieces of songs, filling in the many gaps with her own made-up words that approximate the sounds of Mama's old country tongue. Lily converses fluently in the made-up language, unaware which words are authentic, which invented, witch hybrid. The meaning resides in the music and the privacy of their magic carpet bed. Arabian Nights. Later that evening, when Mercedes has gone into the kitchen to make cocoa for everyone, Lily slips off Daddy's lap in the wingback chair without waking him, and quietly asks Francis to redo her bandage. Mercedes has wrapped it a little too tightly. Sweet 16. Francis has grown an inch and a half. She is now 5 feet tall and old enough to quit school. And she would, except that Daddy will not hear of it. Francis wants to get out in the world and garner some practical experience so she can join the French Foreign Legion as a nurse. She wants to cross the desert disguised as a camel driver by day and a seductress by night, smuggling secret documents to the Allies. Mata Hari and her seven veils. Except that Francis would escape the firing squad at the last second. But Daddy only ever has one response, regardless of the extravagance of Francis's ambitions. Even spies, especially spies, need an education. Francis has already shamed Mercedes by flunking 2 grades. Not that it makes much difference, seeing how they were both put ahead a year when they started, owing to the fact that they could already read and do long division. So by Francis's calculations, she has really only flunked 1 grade. Francis always sat at the back of the class with the hulking boys until the teacher realized it was best to move her up front. She has become pretty tight with the Corneliuses. Cornelius the younger has turned out nice. His friends call him Pussy. Everyone expects him to be a priest because no one can imagine him as a miner or a soldier. Cornelius the older is nasty. His nickname is Petal. Francis saw Petal's thing 3 years ago, but she has never shown him hers. From Petal, Francis extorted forbidden information and cigarettes in exchange for false hope. Petal always thought Francis was going to let him demonstrate his lessons one of these days, but Francis would just tell him, "You're nothing but a brute. Piss off." Petal quit school last year and moved to Vermont to cut wood and terrorize Americans. So, aside from Pussy and Mercedes, who don't count, Francis is without a worthy ally at Mount Carmel. Unless you can call Sister St. Eustace Martyr an ally. She is the principal, and therefore Francis's arch-enemy. Not because she has threatened to expel Francis, but because she refuses to. And how else is Francis going to get out of school? Francis has done many bad things to this end. None of them, however, seems to have been quite bad enough for Sister St. Eustace, a woman whose faith, judging by her belief in Francis, could move mountains. "You have God-given ability, Francis. When are you going to apply yourself?" Silence. Smell of beeswax. Francis fidgets. Sister persists. "There are scholarships available for bright students, but you'll have to buckle down and start achieving consistently." "Yes, Sister St. Useless. Thank you." Francis thinks Sister St. Eustace does not notice. Or, "Why do you do these things, Francis?" This could refer to anything from theft or defacement of other people's property to reducing a fellow pupil to tears by telling her that her parents have just been killed in an automobile accident. "Your mother's head came right off." "Why, Francis, when we know that deep down you're a good girl." "I'm sorry, sister. I'll try to behave in a way that's worthy of all the special efforts you make on my behalf." "What about what's worthy of you, Francis?" Silence. Francis glances up at poor disappointed Jesus on the cross. She glances down at her nicotine fingers. "What do you want to be when you grow up, Francis?"
"A cabaret parasite."
Sister's expression does not change. Francis grows beet red under the beady blue gaze. Finally, "You know, Francis, sometimes it's the wildest girls who end up with the strongest vocations." No way I'm being a nun.
But you don't have to become a nun to get a good education and pursue a satisfying career.
Women can do anything nowadays. You're an intelligent girl, Frances. The world is your oyster.
Yeah, slimy and smelly.
Frances wonders, what will it take to get free? Because all Sister St. Eustace does is poke at an old and tender bruise that reminds Frances what a bad apple she really is. Frances has been going stir-crazy waiting for her life to begin. She has cut the sleeves off most of her dresses and shortened them herself. Uneven is all the rage. She has decided she has a perfect figure, which is none. She removes the ribbons from her braids and ties them around her forehead. And she has experimented with the bejeweled brow look, courtesy of Mercedes' opal rosary. In the toe of an odd stocking in her drawer, she keeps a tube of Rose of Araby lipstick she swiped from McIsaac's. She has always scorched her hair in an effort to straighten it. And always before her mind's eye is Louise Brooks, with her jet-black shingle and fringe. Louise Brooks has usurped Lillian Gish in Frances's heart and on her wall. Lillian survives now only in an honorary capacity, alone on her virginal ice flow. Louise smolders from beneath a black widow's veil, smirks in a tuxedo, flirts over the rim of a champagne glass, simpers on Jack the Ripper's knee, and sprawls in a wicked heap, naked but for a handful of feathers. She is the best and the worst girl in the world. She is also the most modern. Frances longs to be sold into a life of sin, forced onto the stage and into houses of ill fame, where life is tragic but so much fun. In the meantime, she plays hooky down by the shore or at the picture house. Lately, she has taken to walking and trotting the shore road all 9 miles into Sydney, where she heads for the docks of the Esplanade and hangs around the ships. She's thinking about stowing away. She chats with merchant sailors from all over the world and entertains them with her own skinamalink step-dance Charleston for pennies. Lets the odd nasty one touch her chest for a quarter before taking to her heels. The only thing that keeps Frances from running away is Lily. She has to make sure that Lily is okay before she can let her life begin. What okay means is not clear. Frances will know it when she sees it. For now, she contents herself with a fresh diversion. On November 12th, she follows James to his secret place in the woods. It was difficult because she didn't have a car to follow him in, and besides, he would notice that. So, she went on the floor of the back seat of his hupmobile under a blanket. When the car stops, she hears him get out. Then she hears another automobile drive up. Sounds like a truck. She hears James's voice and another man's, soft and deep. She waits until their footsteps scuff away. Then she carefully rises and peeps out the window. There is a shack with smoke coming out the top of a tin chimney. I was right. Her elation is such that she reflexively ducks back down, as though she had made a noise. She peeps out again, in time to see James come out of the shack and stand with his back to her. Nearby is a truck, its trailer covered with a tarpaulin stretched up and over a frame of wooden ribs like a covered wagon. The other man comes out of the shack carrying a big barrel on his shoulder. He is familiar to Frances, but she cannot place him. He is a substantial man, though not unusually tall, with wide shoulders and chest, obviously strong, but there are no sharp edges to him. His body is a pile of cushions.
His face is an open invitation to come in and relax.
Honest round forehead, large eyes. There is an overall quality that Frances racks her brains to identify. Then it comes to her. He looks kind. Something about him reminds Frances of Lily. Maybe that's why he seems familiar. The man rolls the barrel off his shoulder and into the back of his truck, where Francis sees a name stenciled Leo Taylor Transport. This, too, is familiar, but just out of reach. Francis watches as the man carries barrel after barrel and case after clinking case while James waits. When the man has finished, he ties the canvas flaps of the tarp together. James takes a roll of bills out of his pocket and peels off a few. The man says, "Thanks, Mr. Piper." And James says, "All right, Leo. Drive safe." Let me call you sweetheart.
You know why you have a bootleg, Lily? 'Cause I got infantile paralysis when I was a wee tiny baby, but God wanted me to live.
It's a rainy Saturday afternoon. Francis and Lily have been playing covered wagon on Mercedes' bed. Mercedes is off volunteering at the hospital, and Daddy is out Francis knows where. The chenille spread is the wagon cover, and behind them are the children. Diphtheria Rose, Raggedy Lily of the Valley, Spanish Influenza, Maurice, and the rest. They are a pioneer family bound for the frontier, shortly to be scalped. Lily has finally got the reins.
"You caught it in the creek."
The horses stop. Lily waits.
"You caught it in the creek because Mama tried to drown you as soon as you were born."
"Francis!"
Quivering lip. This is the worst thing Francis has ever said.
"Mama loved me. She wouldn't hurt me."
"You were a dark baby. You and Ambrose."
"Francis, Daddy says..."
"He's not your daddy."
"He is so!"
"Shut up, Lily, or I won't tell you anything." Whispering,
"He is so..."
Francis gets up and heads for the door. "Never mind, Lily, 'cause obviously you don't even want to know who your real father is."
"Yes, I do."
Francis takes a long look at Lily, as though assessing her ability to withstand the truth. Then, "Your father is a black man from the coke ovens in Whitney Pier." Lily takes it in. "Mama tried to drown you 'cause you were dark." Every time Francis tells the true story, the story gets a little truer. "I saved you, Lily." Lily bites her lip. Francis's lips have gone white hard. Her throat is a white rope.
"From drowning?"
"Drowning, not drowning, stupid." Francis tosses the dolls onto the floor and begins to make the bed. Lily's silky black eyebrows tremble.
"Mama killed Ambrose?"
"That's right." Suddenly offhand, an efficient plump of the pillow. Lily starts to cry. Francis points out reasonably,
"She was afraid Daddy would kill her." "But he wouldn't."
Lily sobs. Francis watches for a moment. She always feels immensely relieved when Lily starts to cry. She sits beside Lily, puts an arm around her and strokes her sweet head. "Dear Lily."
"It's okay, Lily. Daddy could never hurt anyone."
"Ever."
"I won't tell you any more. You're too little."
"I am not."
Lily pulls away, swatting the tears off her cheeks.
"Yes, you are, Lily. You're a sweet little girl."
"Tell me, Francis. I'm big."
"Little."
"Big."
"Tiny."
"No."
"Oui."
"Tell me."
Lily, bright red, fists pounding the bed. Francis flops back on the pillow, hands folded behind her head, and casually sings, one foot resting on the other knee and bobbing time, "Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous?" Lily starts tearing apart the freshly made bed. "Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous?" Bedspread yanked out from under Francis. "Mademoiselle from Armentières," strewn sheets, rosary attached with a safety pin, "hasn't been kissed in 40 years. Lily could pass out with rage. "Inky dinky, parlez-vous?" She whirls around the room, grabs a big book and tears off the spine. She rips up hunks of pages and throws them out the window. She whips the gutted binding down after them like a blown-off shingle, spins back on her sturdy leg, her steel brace propelling out to the side, and spots the old-fashioned girl that plays Let Me Call You Sweetheart. It holds a yellow parasol. It lives on Mercedes' dresser on a doily all its own. Lily grabs it.
Tell me, Frances, or I'll smash it.
I'm not telling you anything. You're a maniac. Lily's arm swings up.
Tell me.
No.
Lily pauses. The enormity of the idea of throwing the old-fashioned girl to the floor threatens to sink in, so she simply lets the figurine drop. It hits the floor. The parasol and the head. Clink. Roll, roll, ruddle, ruddle.
Lily looks in shock at what she's done. Frances delivers the punchline.
If you were doing all this to get back at me, you didn't. All you did was wreck Mercedes' precious things.
Again. Oh, no.
Lily stands with parted lips and puckered forehead. Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no.
Okay, Lily. I'll tell you.
Lily can't remember what Frances is talking about, but you have to swear.
Lily just stands there.
Don't worry, Lily. We'll clean it all up.
But some things are broken.
We'll fix them. Don't worry. Swear.
I swear.
You have to swear on something.
On Raggedy Lily of the Valley.
This makes Lily feel teary because she imagines how she'd feel if someone came along and did to Raggedy Lily of the Valley what she has just done to the old-fashioned girl. Raggedy Lily of the Valley with her head off. Little bits of gray material coming out. But Frances has other stakes in mind.
Swear on your bootleg.
On my little leg.
May it be cut off if you speak of this again.
Lily looks down at her legs, the strong right one and the wispy left one. In its sincere beige wool stocking, which sags like empty skin within the steel harness, its high narrow shoe with the mild horse's face, the iron bit clamped under the sole. Her heel is much better now. There's just a scab from Armistice Day.
Okay, says Lily. Don't worry, little leg. I'll keep my vow.
Okay. Well, Mama went crazy from shame of what she did with the man from the coke ovens. Plus, she was dying of a wound she got because Daddy had cut you and Ambrose out of her stomach with his bayonet.
Make yourself cozy now.
It was the middle of the night. Daddy left her sleeping and went to get the doctor. But she got up even though she was cut open.
Frances has slipped into the eerie voice of the stray orange cat story. It's the voice she uses when she is telling the truth. I was at my bedroom window wearing my tartan house coat. I saw Mama down in the creek. Ambrose was lying on the bottom. She was just about to do the same thing to you. But she looked up and she saw me watching her, so she stopped. There was a bright, bright moon, and I just looked her in the eye like that till Daddy came and dragged her back to the house with you. Then she died.
Poor Mama,
Lily weeps.
Frances blinks finally.
Poor Mama? She tried to kill you, you idiot. I'm the one who saved you.
Why didn't you save Mama?
No one could save Mama.
You saved me.
Yes, you dunce, I saved you.
Thank you, Frances.
Lily hugs Frances.
Does Daddy know?
That I saved you? Yes.
Does he know he's not my real Daddy?
Yes, but you can never mention it, Lily. It would really hurt him. 'Cause even though you're not his, he loves you more than the rest of us.
He loves you too, Frances.
Yes, but he loves you the most.
I want him to love you the most, too.
It's all right, Lily. It's supposed to be this way.
I love you the most, Frances.
What about Daddy and Mercedes?
I love them the most, too.
There's no such thing as loving everyone the most. Mercedes spent the morning at New Waterford General Hospital. She read aloud to a veteran who had been gassed in the war, emptied bedpans, changed the water in vases, and generally made herself useful. She'd have brought Lily, but Daddy wants to make sure Lily's foot is completely healed before she ventures out. After the hospital, Mercedes went to Mount Carmel Church and helped the nuns polish the communion rail and dust the altar. She lit a candle, knelt at the base of the beautiful 8-foot Mary, and said a few prayers for Mama and Kathleen and Valentino and all the poor captive souls in purgatory. Valentino died 3 years ago. The day she heard the impossible news, it was all Mercedes could do to keep from running to Helen Fry's house. She found the strength to forbear. It's simple, really. Just don't move, and you won't do anything you'll regret later. Mercedes spent that day sitting, enervated, on the edge of her bed, staring at Valentino's picture. When she got up, it was to replace his face in the frame with a poem she had come across in Reader's Digest called Don't Whine. Mercedes always crosses the street when she sees Helen Fry. Helen looks wistfully at Mercedes, although she has given up saying hello. The Fries must know by now how wrong they were. No doubt Helen has shed her share of hot tears. Good enough for them. Mercedes hasn't wasted time on silly girlfriends since Fry. She has been too busy with school and family. Here is the order of priorities. God, family, school, piano, friends. Mercedes will soon turn 17. November is the one month when she and Frances are the same age. Mercedes is in her final year of high school. She is a definite for a scholarship to St. Francis Xavier University on the mainland. Surely Daddy will be able to spare her by then. She tries not to be selfish about it, but she wants so badly to go to university. It's too late for her other ambition, to be the best student ever to grace the halls of Holy Angels. She has settled for being the best Mount Carmel has ever seen, and among the best in the province. All this, and cooking and cleaning and babysitting, too. Mercedes tries not to be proud, only grateful. Think of how many girls never even get to finish high school. Think of the poor children who share a single pair of shoes among a whole family. Mercedes leaves the church, raises her umbrella, and walks down Plummer Avenue through the steady drizzle, nodding polite greetings left and right. Despite her youth, many people call her Miss Piper. It seems natural, partly because of her bearing and good works, partly because of her grooming. She is swathed in tweed, crisp in a white blouse and black necktie, gloved with a straw boater angled on her pale bun. She never fails to wear a hat and gloves, not just out of seemliness, but because, summer or winter, she darkens rather too readily. In Paris, Coco Chanel has just invented the suntan, but the word hasn't reached New Waterford. Beneath it all, Mercedes is decently corseted and petticoated. Frances has told her she looks as though she just stepped out of the time machine. But good taste is always in style. Truly, civilization is a thin veneer. For what have we to distinguish us from the beasts of the field? Besides, of course, an immortal soul, manners, and suitable attire. One effect of cultivating the virtue of charity is the realization that the Mahmoods over in Sydney require her prayers. So, along with the dead, Mercedes prays for her unknown relatives. She is praying for them now, inwardly, as she passes the new gasoline pumps and nods to Mr. McIsaac. It slipped her mind in church. But there is no such thing as an inconvenient moment when it comes to prayer. That's the marvelous thing about it. Please, dear God, Don't judge too harshly your servants in Sydney who cast out their own flesh and blood. Amen. Although Mercedes was too young to respond mercifully to the first 25 years of disaster, she has been working hard to make up for it. And there's plenty of time. This is, after all, only 1929. In the grievously wounded but still young 20th century, Mercedes finishes her prayer with a discreet sign of the cross etched with her index finger upon her thumb, and turns into Lvovitz's kosher Canadian to buy a roast for Sunday's supper. Lvovitz's delicatessen has expanded to include fruits, vegetables, tinned goods, dry goods, and bins of bulk comestibles, because few people can afford to buy meat on a regular basis. The bell rings as Mercedes opens the door, and Ralph Lvovitz looks up from behind the counter. The tips of his adorable, sticking-out ears turn red as the stripes in his apron when he sees her. Mercedes looks as young as she is the moment she smiles at him. They exchange pleasantries, avoiding and catching one another's eyes, as he draws out the process of measuring and cutting brown paper, unwinding a length of string, selecting just the right roast, wrapping it, and tying it up. At the end of the process, it seems to slip his mind that Mercedes is waiting for him to hand the package to her. Neither does Mercedes remind him.
"How is the clarinet going, Ralph?" she inquires.
"I've been practicing." "Good. Are you
sorry?"
"Sorry."
Smile.
"Are you still able to come over Sunday evening?" asks Ralph.
"Oh, yes. May I bring the girls?"
"Of course. That'd be grand."
Smile. Mercedes reflects, not for the first time, that Ralph's shiny brown eyes and sandy curls are somehow more pleasing than Valentino's turban and charcoal glowers. Perhaps it's because, if she reached out right now, she could touch Ralph. She blushes afresh and fumbles for the roast. Ralph drops it. They've known one another all their lives, but suddenly, over the past few months, they've become terribly polite. It is a change that is not lost on Mrs. Lvovitz, who is taking inventory across the aisle. Mercedes is a good girl, a wonderful girl. I helped bring her into this world. I loved her mother like a daughter, but... the problem is, if Mr. and Mrs. Lvovitz are to have grandchildren, Jewish grandchildren, well, it can't be a Shana Catholic Maidela, now can it?
"Relax," Benny has told her. "How can I relax? You want a Catholic grandchild." "A grandchild would be nice."
Mrs. Lvovitz gets choked up and can't continue the argument. Benny says,
"Come here, come here."
She does, he says.
"You want he should go away to school, and you want he should stay home."
She nods. He says,
"You want he should be a doctor, and you want he should be a grocer."
She nods again, smiling now through tears.
"And," says Benny, "he should marry a nice Jewish girl and move into a house down the street."
She nods, stuffing a hanky in between his shoulder and her nose.
"You know, Liebkeit, we're the ones who came here. If we'd stayed in the old country, there'd be plenty of nice Jewish girls. It's not Ralph's fault we made him be born here."
He pauses.
"And it's not his fault that..."
But he doesn't have to continue. They both know. If Abe and Rudy had not been killed in the war, Mrs. Lvovitz would not have such a problem letting Ralph marry Mercedes. Over the tins of Dutch cleanser, Mrs. Lvovitz watches Mercedes count out the money for Ralph, and she watches him meticulously place it in the cash register. She sees him slip a chocolate rosebud into Mercedes' hand before she leaves. Mercedes exits Lvovitz's kosher Canadian feeling light-headed. Maintaining the pink glow on her cheeks for several blocks is the thought of what her and Ralph's children would look like.
Mercedes Lvovitz. Mrs. Ralph Lvovitz.
Their children would be Catholic, of course. Mercedes indulges herself until King Street, then reins in her thoughts and remembers to open her umbrella. I wonder if Francis and Lily went on their picnic. I hope not in this weather.
She turns on to Water Street and sees that Daddy is not yet home.
Just as well. I feel like a little lie-down before starting supper.
Mercedes mounts the stairs to her room. The house is quiet. Lily and Francis must have gone on their picnic after all. It's sweet of Francis to play with Lily so much. It means Lily's not constantly on my hands. But I could wish Francis had a friend her own age.
A nice one.
Mercedes lies down on her perfectly made bed and allows her eyes to travel contentedly about her room. She has only fine things. Books. On her bedside table she has framed the old photograph of Mama and Daddy in the archway. And safely hidden is the one surviving photograph of Kathleen. What's it doing on the floor? It's always tucked inside Jane Eyre, where Daddy won't have to come across it. Mercedes reaches down, picks up the photo, and puts it on her bedside table. She'll tuck it back into the book after she has a little ziz. Mercedes' eyes come drowsily to rest on the wall above her dresser, where she has hung the portrait of Our Lady appearing to Bernadette in the grotto at Lourdes. Yellow roses sprout between the toes of Our Lady, and arranged in a halo about her head are the words she said to Bernadette, "I am the Immaculate Conception." A stream runs between them. The stream that became the healing waters of Lourdes, and now provides 3 times 9,000 gallons every day. Our Lady appeared to Bernadette 3 times 6 times. She told Bernadette 3 times to drink from the stream, which Bernadette did after throwing away the first 3 handfuls of water. Our Lady told her 3 secrets that Bernadette carried to the grave. Bernadette escaped all the publicity by becoming a nun. In the convent, she helped out in the hospital and the chapel and struggled to control her lifelong bad temper. When asked what she was doing, Bernadette replied, "Getting on with my work, being ill." 3 days after the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, she became bedridden. At 3 times 12 years old, she died of asthma, tuberculosis, and a tumor on the knee. She received extreme unction 3 times. 3 nuns knelt by her at her death, and now 3 million faithful a year flock to 3 basilicas at Lourdes, where the waters occasionally effect a miraculous cure. Mercedes has become very sleepy thinking about Bernadette. As her eyes drift down from the picture, they naturally fall upon the figurine of the dear old-fashioned girl. Mercedes' eyes lurch open. Diabolical. The old-fashioned girl has a parasol for a head and a head for a parasol. She is daintily holding up her own head of ringlets to the sun, while the insensate yellow parasol is implanted in the empty neck like a flag. Francis. Mercedes blinks back tears. It's always like this. The minute I have something good, something clean. She goes to the dresser, tidying her tears with a thin, trembling wrist. She examines the body. The pieces have been glued like that. There's no fixing this. At least not now. What to do with it? Where to put it in the meantime, where it won't be like an obscene smell, invisible yet oppressive? The hope chest. It's been kept locked ever since Francis dressed Trixie in the baptismal gown. Mercedes has the key. She picks up the disfigurine without looking at it. It tinkles briefly. On the way, she picks up the photo of Kathleen, intending to replace it between the leaves of Jane Eyre. But Jane has flown. She is not on the shelf near the window. She is nowhere to be seen. Francis must have borrowed her. Again.
First things first. Mercedes will hunt for the book later. She puts Kathleen in her pocket and walks to the foot of the attic stairs. Listens. Silence. She mounts the stairs. The attic is so empty. Nothing but the hope chest. Even the attic's one other distinguishing feature is an absence. A crisscross halfway up the wall where a crucifix used to be. Mercedes remembers when this was Kathleen's bedroom. Before she died here, peacefully, in her sleep. The hope chest is a good place to store things like the ruined old-fashioned girl, because the attic is so separate from the rest of the house. In a state of perpetual quarantine. It's really an abandoned room.
That's why the sad feeling here,
Mercedes supposes. Sad like a deconsecrated church.
Maybe I'll put a crucifix back up here, if I think of it next time.
Or no, because then you couldn't store anything up here like the ruined old-fashioned girl. Mercedes sees the practical benefit of having a non-room in the house. She opens the hope chest. The cedar smell clouds up, soft and alive, resurrecting an old grief. Mercedes has no wish to linger here or to rummage in the past. She takes what is to hand. The baptismal gown is at the top of the pile from the Trixie incident, and wraps the old-fashioned girl in it. After what the garment has been through, this can hardly be considered a desecration. She closes the lid and locks it. She stands for a moment in the emptiest of rooms, then leaves, quietly closing the door behind her. Mercedes feels calmer by the time she arrives in the living room. Daddy will be home soon, and she mustn't show that anything's wrong. She sits down at the piano. No doubt Lily knocked over the figurine by accident. She is a child, after all. Jab, jab, jab at that sticky C-sharp. Daddy keeps saying he's going to fix it, but never does. Mercedes is under the impression that she has forgiven Lily for the family tree incident, and now she is preparing herself to forgive Francis for mutilating the old-fashioned girl. She turns to page 32 in Everybody's Favorite Songs. Oddly, Mercedes has always found it much easier to forgive Francis than to forgive Lily, even though Francis is satanically inspired,
and Lily is unarguably innocent.
Mercedes needs to forgive Francis the same way Francis needs to comfort Lily. Mercedes goes to touch down lightly on the keys, but stops and reaches into her pocket, where she has forgotten Kathleen. She takes the photo out and props it on the music ledge next to the songbook. Kathleen in her holy angel's uniform, hands on her knees, laughing. She was beautiful. A slight blur around her hair because she wouldn't keep still long enough for the camera.
There, says Mercedes to Kathleen with her mind. You can listen and watch, and I'll play you a song.
Mercedes starts to play, and to sing sincerely.
Darling, I am growing old. Silver threads among the gold shine upon my brow today. Life is fading fast away. But, my darling, you will be always young and fair to me. Yes, my darling, you will be always young and fair to me.
Trixie, Francis, then Lily quietly file in. Lily's face is black with coal except for a wide oval around her mouth. Mercedes sees them but keeps singing. Francis looks at Mercedes and figures, I guess she hasn't been up to her room yet. Francis, Lily, and Trixie sit on